call the Senate Committee on Health Care and Veterans Affairs to order. It is April 16th, and we have a huge agenda, and so I doubt if we can get through all of it this morning, and so we do have time from 6 to 8 this evening for those for bills that we're not able to get through all of them this morning. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 16. And Dr. Nash, come on up.
Actually, there's three of them. I think they're coming up.
And the three of you.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 16, this is our first public hearing, adds authorization of short-term hospitalization for treatment of dementia to actions that healthcare representatives may make on behalf of persons executing advance healthcare directives.
And colleagues, this has been an issue that Dr. Nash brought to me, and if she could give the committee, when she testifies, a little bit of background on there are so many now people that have dementia, and those of us who are baby boomers, there's going to even be even more people who have dementia, and it's been very difficult, at least from Dr. Nash's point of view, of being able to care for these people with the way our court system is. So with that, Dr. Nash, will you give a little bit more history here? And
yeah, hi.
And introduce yourself for the record.
Right. I'm Maureen Nash. I'm a psychiatrist and an internal medicine physician. I practice full-time as a geriatric psychiatrist at the Tuolity Center for Geriatric Psychiatry in Forest Grove. That's a 21-bed inpatient unit. I also have an outpatient practice. The Tuolity Center for Geriatric Psychiatry is a referral center for all of Oregon. You know, we've had citizens from 23 of Oregon's 36 counties in the last year. We've had citizens from 28 counties in the last 10 years at our hospital. So, you know, we see folks from a broad range of the state. Currently, there is approaching our shores a tsunami wave of folks with dementia. Age is the biggest risk factor for dementia. One in 165-year-olds have dementia. One in 20 people age 70 have dementia. Roughly one in five people age 80 have dementia. And roughly almost half of people who are older than 85 have dementia. So it's a very common illness. The baby boomers begin to reach age 65 in 2 years. So there is a huge crest coming with an exponential increase in the number of people affected. Between, depending on how you define it, 40 and 90% of folks who have dementia will have significant behavior disturbance at some point in their illness. So what we end up with are folks who are very confused, who are dangerous to themselves or others, you know, and it's, of course, totally out of their control because parts of their brain are dying off, which is what dementia really is. So when that happens, often you can end up in an emergency situation where people need hospitalization. And this is sort of where the healthcare power of attorney comes in. Currently, under Oregon law, all psychiatric treatment for any reason is excluded under the healthcare power of attorney. A lot of complicated reasons for that. But dementia is different from other forms of mental illness. Dementia with behavior disturbance certainly can have a lot of symptoms that overlap with it, paranoia, suspiciousness. But 100% of people who have dementia will become incapacitated as part of their illness if they live that long, 100%. That's radically different from the case for most people with psychiatric illness. So what you end up with is an emergency situation, a very confused older adult who doesn't understand that they're impaired, doesn't understand that they need help, and it's clear to lots of people that they do need help. So if that person is in the emergency room, you know, your father, your mother, your aunt, there's several choices in the state of Oregon. One is an involuntary commitment under the mental health statutes to get a person help. The other is if a person already has a guardian. While someone is in the hospital, a family member can go for temporary guardianship, but that is an expensive process. Often a person needs temporary and permanent guardianship. The cost is about double. It's an emergency situation. People have to come up with thousands of dollars on short notice, which for any of us is a challenge. And it puts families through an extra emotional stress. And what I had thought about was many of these older adults come to us with medical power of attorney, healthcare representative, paperwork, and so they have already chosen someone to make medical decisions for them. Family members and many lawyers routinely assume that that applies to treatment for their dementia and dementia-related behavioral problems, but it doesn't. So people are often surprised and astounded. I mean, just earlier this week I had a conversation. Well, I have a healthcare power of attorney for my father. I said, well, I'm sorry, under the current Oregon law, that doesn't allow you to make health care decisions in this case for your father. It's carved out under the statute. So basically, I think we need a way to protect people's civil rights, to get them the care that they need, to take care of people, keep people safe, and if at all we can decrease the suffering, the emotional toll of this, I think that is a very real plus. It also offers Oregonians some financial relief for folks who end up in this situation. So this is a situation that really affects a fairly small number of folks in Oregon, but the effect on each person is large. And so that's sort of the genesis for where this change in the healthcare power of attorney law, that was my rationale for it. You know, most folks who have behavior disturbance related to their dementia can be stabilized and safely discharged to the community in less than 14 days. So we're not talking about, we're not talking about state hospital. We're not talking about long-term hospitalization. The vast majority of cases, it's just like any other hospital stay from the point of view of the patient and their family members, except for this legal difference. I gave two pages of written testimony there, but I think that sort of summarizes where I'm coming from with this bill. And we've had the number of people referred to our inpatient unit has increased 35% or so in the last year, and the year before that it was a 20% increase. The number of people, there's this huge wave of people who are going to be having these problems, and it behooves us to take a look at that and do what we can to make the situation better for the citizens of Oregon.
And the way the Dash 1 amendments read, are you in favor of the Dash 1s, which basically for the dementia and behavior caused by dementia are not mental illness?
As long as that is restricted to the statute ORS 127, the healthcare power of attorney, I don't object.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chairman, fellow committee members, my name is Keith Wolford. Dr. Nash asked me to write a letter to her expressing my experiences in this issue, and I feel very passionate about it enough to come down and testify this morning. I'd like to just give you a brief overview. I'm not going to try to read my letter because you're going to have the opportunity to read that yourselves. But my mother, in the last 10 years of her life, had dementia, and because of an only child myself, I had that responsibility to take care of her, and I did the legal things to make that happen. I acquired a power, medical power of attorney, and so I was able to take care of her medical and financial situation without any problem. Fortunately, she didn't have to go through a psychiatric unit, and so I was able to do it with the medical power of attorney and everything else. So I've got a little bit of experience. And then in 2001, my wife, 54 years old, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. So here again, I came to the need to take care of someone, a loved one with dementia-related issues. So there, with my experience, I was able to acquire a power of attorney for her medical and financial needs, and that served the purpose until in September of last year, she was admitted to Tualatin, where Dr. Nash works. And I found out at that time the possibility that I was going to need a guardianship, and because my wife was there just a short period of time, we didn't need to pursue that. They were able to put a hold on her and keep her for the 10 days that she was there. So she went back to a normal care facility, and then again in December she exhibited some of the same issues. So we were back at Tualatin for a longer period of time this time. And at that time they told me that I needed to acquire a guardianship, and like Dr. Nash expressed earlier in her testimony, I thought, well, I have a power of attorney to address the medical needs. Why do I need a guardianship? And with my layman knowledge, I didn't understand why I needed a guardianship, and it was finally expressed to me that for her to continue to stay there without a court order, I would need to attain a guardianship, and then she ended up getting transferred to the state hospital, which requires a guardianship as well. And I would ask the committee today to consider the fact that it's very, very difficult for somebody to deal with these situations under a normal basis, and then to have the expense of a guardianship thrown in the middle of that. It's a pretty traumatic thing to have to deal with, and I would encourage the committee to consider this bill and pass it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I am Tina Kitson. I'm the medical director for seniors and people with disabilities, and we come together today to support Senate Bill 16 with the Dash 1 amendments. And if you can bear with me for just a few seconds, I will try to explain why I think that the Dash 1 amendments are needed. First off, let me thank Dr. Nash for bringing this problem forward, and Chair, for your personal interest in this bill. I think that for people to have access to these services as they go through dementia is extremely important, and we need to make it as easy as possible within reasonable limits so that people's rights are not trampled upon, but that people can get access to the care. When I participated in the original discussion around the Oregon Healthcare Decisions Act through two sessions with the late Senator Frank Roberts' committee, there was a prohibition in place on healthcare representatives from being allowed to make decisions, and specifically that language was put around admission to a healthcare facility for the purposes of treatment of a mental illness. And at that time, people were thinking traditional mental illnesses, schizophrenia, manic depression, those sorts of mental illnesses, and separately put in degenerative conditions and not thinking dementia. So I was personally actually a bit surprised that hospital lawyers and the medical community was interpreting that as psychiatric care for all sorts of conditions, and that these barriers was being put up around admission and not allowing healthcare representatives to consent to treatment even by a psychiatrist in a psychiatric facility. So I think the Dash 1 amendments clarify that for the respect for this ORS 127 for the Healthcare Decisions Act, that dementia is not considered a mental illness, and therefore healthcare representatives are allowed that authority to make those decisions. And we think it's very appropriate if people take the time and the effort to appoint a loved one or someone that they trust to make their medical decisions for them, they should be allowed to make those medical decisions. And we think that the Dash 1 amendments get us there.
So in this case, if we would pass this bill, then the situation that, is it Dr. Wilford?
No.
Mr. Wilford,
yeah,
would have that he would have been able to start making decisions for his mother.
Wife.
His wife.
Well, I mean wife.
Yes. Yes, we wouldn't have needed, a different mechanism to protect his wife's civil rights. He would protect his civil rights as she had intended when she filled out the medical power of attorney.
And is it easy for a physician to determine whether a person has a mental illness or dementia?
It is very obvious when someone has a moderate or severe dementia. And it's very obvious the difference between that and someone who suffers from schizophrenia, especially if you take into account a person's history. The only time it is a challenge would be in someone who has both.
That's what I was saying.
That can make it a little bit more challenging.
Yeah.
But clinically, the inability to form new memories is profound, especially in Alzheimer's-type dementia, which is the most common kind of dementia. 70% of people with dementia have Alzheimer's dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and the primary deficit there is an inability to form a new memory, just an entire inability to form a new memory, and that is extremely disabling. And that is not a problem that people with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder suffer from. I'm not certain that every layperson on the street could make the distinction, but I'm reasonably confident that the licensed physicians in the state of Oregon can make a distinction.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for mentioning that particular situation. I was going to raise that issue. And so how do you deal with it if a person has been diagnosed with bipolar and is on medication and is doing just fine and then starts into the dementia area? So do you stay with the mental illness diagnosis, or do you kind of separate?
Everybody who's admitted to a hospital has a primary diagnosis. So they are diagnosed with something, and that is what is listed first. And you list first what is the cause of the need for this hospitalization. So if the physician's treating a person list bipolar disorder as the first thing, then that would be the primary diagnosis. And court investigators, if it came down to it and you needed, and a person didn't understand they needed treatment, and multiple physicians felt strongly that a person really needed treatment, was a danger to themselves or others, and it would be unsafe to discharge them in their current condition, you know, the court commitment process is right there. And my experience in the state of Oregon is that people work overtime to make sure that people's rights are respected. And I've worked in 6 or 7 different states, and this is the hardest place I've ever worked to take care of people who are sick, in the sense of Oregonians tolerate a high level of sickness in the people in the community. And so in the case of someone with a both coexisting mental illness and dementia, you know, if there's any question, one can always initiate a hold. Physicians can initiate a hold and go through the court commitment process, have court investigators and judges involved that way. Family members can go and to the county mental health through the county mental health department. Family members or others concerned about a person would have that right to do that. And frankly, a person themselves would have the right to raise a red flag and protest it. And if someone is well enough to formulate a strong protest, that actually is very suggestive of a lack of dementia.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, has there been discussions, Tina, with the Alzheimer's group?
Chair Anderson, Ms. Anderson, the Alzheimer's group is supporting it as amended. They have been involved in the discussions around the original bill and with the development of the amendments.
I have here, I just see it, from the Alzheimer's Association, and they do support the adoption of Senate Bill 16, and they go into saying that this is... that the Alzheimer's Association is working towards increasing awareness of the need for advanced planning, and these are extremely difficult decisions, especially at the end of life. And as the disease progresses, people with behavioral issues related to dementia may need to move between care settings in order to receive the most appropriate level of care. And so this basically creates a planning tool that these families can elect to use ahead of time to facilitate such transitions. All righty. Thank you very much. We don't have anyone in opposition to this, but I see some people in the audience. I'd like to have Bob Joondeff make sure that his group is okay with this bill as amended. And I think... there were some attorneys that were opposed to this concept last session in 2007 when we tried to deal with it, so it would be nice to get their input also. And we only have three more meetings after this one, so we are going to be requesting a fiscal on this, and I intend to move the bill if we don't have major opposition and if the committee so desires.
We have a fiscal on it.
Oh, we have the fiscal.
We have a fiscal on the bill, on the dash one.
On the dash one.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, do you want to come forward? And I don't see the attorneys that were so opposed to this. I had at least 10 of them in the room with Dr. Nash about a year ago.
It does.
They aren't here today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Joondeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I've spent quite some time working on this bill. I think that the Dash 1 amendments reflect a very elegant solution to the problem that was posed by Dr. Nash, and we don't have a problem with it.
Let's move it.
Okay. All right. With that, anyone else that would wish to testify at this point in time? I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16 and open a work session on Senate Bill 16 because we do have the fiscal. I didn't realize we had that. And the revenue, and there's no impact at all on state or local governments.
I'm sure I move the dash one amendment, Senate Bill 16.
Senator Cruz moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 16. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I like the way Bob characterized it as an elegant solution. I think that's a good characterization.
Okay. Is there any opposition? Well, no, the clerk should call the roll since we don't have someone here.
Senator Bates?
Excused.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. I will carry the bill.
Chair, we need to. That
oh yes. And now we will continue.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 16 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Moves Senate Bill 16 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Excused.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. There we have motion passes, and I'll carry the bill on the floor, and this is great. Thank you very much, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 16. All right. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5. And will you take over?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 5 allows appointment of adjutant general in grade of lieutenant general. And I'm sure someone's here to explain that. But Senator Courtney was the sponsor, and he's supposed to be here at 8:30.
Since we need to be moving along, General Caldwell, do you want to come forward?
And we don't have the paperwork on this, do we? Okay.
Leave the middle seat for the president upon
okay.
his arrival. I'm sure he'll want to discuss this. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Reagan Military Department, and today before you is a bill that would increase the rank of the Adjutant General from Major General to Lieutenant General. The position of Adjutant General is defined as the head of the Oregon National Guard and also serves in the capacity as the director of the Oregon Military Department, which includes the Office of Emergency Management. Also includes both the Oregon Army National Guard and the Oregon Air National Guard and the Oregon State Defense Force. So there's three military elements that fall within his purview. What has occurred over time is that ranks have migrated toward the top, I guess, is the best way to say it. Throughout military history, I guess you would see that, and the good senator is going to mention some of that in his comments. Presently, after many years of debate and lobbying, to put it bluntly, the Congress last year increased the head of the National Guard Bureau, which is a position that is part of the Department of Defense, from a lieutenant general's position to a general's position, which is 4 stars. That was one of the things that the Guard has lobbied for a number of years, to get on par with the active services, particularly during budget negotiations and force structure negotiations and all the things that happen. So the states are now starting to migrate from a major general rank in the state statute to lieutenant general rank. Currently there are 5 states that do that. So we believe that this will aid the adjutant general, because as you probably don't know, but since I don't see any of you on our budget committee, but 95% of our expenses are paid for by the federal government through the National Guard Bureau. So having that par with the directors that the General Reese has to deal with on a daily basis is extremely important in our eyes to make sure, as the military is very conscious about rank, it really does help our ability to be on par with those that make those decisions and have that credibility. So we support the bill. We think it is probably long overdue. It's been discussed for numerous years around here that I can think of, but the timing just simply wasn't correct. With the advent of the Chief of the Bureau going from Lieutenant General to General, I think time has come, and I think it will put us in good stead with the federal government, as again, who we rely on very heavily for our resources. That concludes my testimony. I'd be more than happy to answer any of your questions and defer to the President of the Senate, who has made it into the room.
President Courtney, we are discussing Senate Bill 5, which allows appointment of Adjutant General and grade of Lieutenant General. And if you want to say a few words, that would be fine.
Make sure this is off, or I'll get fined and taken to jail. Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. I've been in a lot of trouble this time.
We're waiting.
Cruz hates me.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of this August committee.
Okay.
Dave Robinson. You've already started, so you know what's involved here. I'm entering on the record a written statement, as I always do. And I can read it to you, but suffice it to say, as I understand it, and I was asked to introduce this bill and graciously agreed to do so for the head of our Oregon National Guard, Raymond Reese. And we're asking he be elevated to another rank of general. And I'm sure that the individuals here have described all the different generals' rankings there are in the military. As I understand it, there is the four ranks for general. The brigadier, which is a one-star, the major, which is a two-star, the lieutenant, which is a three-star, and then general, which is a four-star. And I happen to know that, I don't know what you call a five-star, but unless you're just a five-star general. There's been some of those, but there are no living five-star generals. And in order to get that fifth star, you got to be, I asked to find out, and I don't know how many five-star generals there have been. Nine. I understand there's been nine five-star generals over history of this country, but there are nine living. And I understand. Nine. I understand. See, I have a great Sasha, who's my staff of staffers here. There have been nine five-star generals over the history of the United States, but their rank is generally thought of as ceremonial. And I understand there are no living five-star generals today. So you get to be a five-star general. That is a very significant honor, and that's how you designate generals, by the number of stars on their shoulders. So we are simply here asking that Raymond Reese be given another star for two reasons, and I don't know whether you've already described this. The head of all the National Guards, and I'm not going to use military terms the way the two gentlemen could on either side of me, since they're career military. They've won many medals in combat, and they're much better than I am in all this area, and I'm their humble servant. But as I understand it, the head of all the National Guards in this country has just been elevated to another star. And therefore, our general could be elevated another star. Otherwise, if you elevated Raymond Reese to this new rank, he would be on a par rank with the present general of the National Guards. But the Congress has elevated the head of all the other National Guards to a higher rank, another star. And so we're asking that that be done as a statement about how we see the parity of the National Guard in a state militia with the federal, to be very frank with you. And other states have done this, as I understand it. The states of Alaska, Georgia, Texas, Maryland, and Nebraska have all taken this action. So we're not asking that anything extraordinarily be done here or that it would fly in the face of military protocol. And I'm intentionally choosing not to use all the different adjutant generals and, you know, all the different terms, brigadier and all that. I'm just trying to speak as a lay person to you. There's another reason, though, to elevate Raymond Reese. If you will go and look at Raymond Reese's record, he came out of Pendleton. He goes to West Point. He also goes to U of O Law School. He has been the head of our National Guard here at least three times. He also was the head of all the National Guards back there in interim bases at least twice. And he didn't get elevated permanently. And I'm not going to get into what that's all about because it involves politics. So not only has he been the head of the Oregon National Guards three separate times, he has been the head of all the National Guards in our countries at least twice on an interim basis. So on that basis alone, meritorious-wise, he deserves another star. We have an extraordinary leader of our Oregon National Guard. I mean, he's extraordinary. I believe it's Cavalry. He's a Cavalry officer. He was in Vietnam. I know some of this stuff. And he's a West Pointer. And I'm not going to tell you how I feel about that because I happen to think the Marines are superior. But the fact is, if you're going to be in the Army, Cavalry is pretty good. I'm not even going to recognize the Air Force. So the Cavalry is pretty good. But you truly are looking at a splendid, splendid officer here. A splendid officer. Notice that. That's better than either one of you could think of. Who has an extraordinary record of service as a general, as an officer, and as an Oregonian to the militia. So I think this is richly deserved on merits as well as richly deserved on the protocol basis. And so I'm not going to read this complicated statement because I read it. It was prepared for me mostly by the good journal on my right. I couldn't understand how he wrote, so we messed with it a bit, and then I decided to come down here and just speak from my heart. So I think I'm pretty right in terms of describing the protocol and the ranks and the stars and the history, but also something I feel strongly. I like Raymond Reese. He doesn't necessarily like me. We have arguments back and forth, but he has that. Raymond Reese is a very stern officer. I mean, he is stern. He is a taskmaster. He's a tolerant individual, but he's a West Pointer, if you get my drift, and he's a cavalry officer. So with that, you're very nice to let me come down here and interrupt these two gentlemen, as well as to interrupt this committee.
Yes, Senator Cruz, and we need to move it quickly. We have a lot of bills.
Something that concerns me, Mr. President. You didn't opine on the Navy, and I just wondered how you felt about them. So.
You know, they're in ships, and they sleep in bunks, and they get hot food. What can I tell you? I mean, you know, we need our Navy. I love boats, but you know, what can I tell you?
Okay, is there any further discussion? Paul?
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, just very briefly, my name is Paul Evans. I'm policy advisor to Governor Kulikowski for military issues. The governor very strongly supports this bill and believes that the issues that the Senate president brought up, I'm not even going to try to get to his level, but those are all important in the case, especially as we go into the future. Thank you.
Okay, we do not have, and you might as well stay there because you're going to be here for the next bill, too, Senate Bill 8. So, with that, we don't have a fiscal or a revenue impact, so we will need to carry this over until we get it. With that, I will thank you very much, gentlemen.
Unless the president let us move it.
Yeah, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 8.
Madam Chair, or is it?
Whatever.
Vice President.
Yeah.
Chair Vice President. Allows volunteer health practitioner licensed in other states and registered with the Volunteer Health Practitioners Registration System to practice health care in Oregon during an emergency.
Thank you, Mr. Shook. Senator Moss Anderson, Mr. President, please proceed.
Thank you. Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Senator Lori Moss Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And this was brought to us by the American College of Surgeons. They have been on, when the terrible disaster happened with Katrina, there were a number of physicians that reacted and went into the state to give help, and they came up with all kinds of problems. And for the record, I'd like to read the letter that was submitted by John Mayberry, and this will actually reflect the problems that the surgeons anyway had. It says, my name is Dr. John Mayberry, representing the American College of Surgeons, and I'm writing in support of Senate Bill 8, the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act. The ASC, that's what American College of Surgeons says, is pleased to see that the committee is considering Senate Bill 8. Last October, the National Board of Regents adopted a formal statement of support for the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act, and they hope that our legislative session will be one of the growing number of states adopting this important disaster response legislation. So that's from him. Another letter from basically Dr. Korndorfer says, actually describes what happened to him in Louisiana. And he says there was a Jim and Jim Mayberry, as well as this Dr. Korndorfer. They are general surgeons, and they moved from Alabama to New Orleans in 2003. And then during the summer, they lived in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, about 60 miles from New Orleans. In August of 2005, they had just begun to move back into the house in New Orleans when the reality of the large hurricane headed their way, it began to sink in. So Jim planned a trip to the Northeast, and having been assured that there was sufficient medical coverage at Tulane University, they boarded the house in Bay, St. Louis, and evacuated then to Pensacola, Florida, so Jim could make his trip. Anyway, like everyone else, they were watching the news. They had contact with the physicians at the Tulane Hospital through a satellite phone, but then all of a sudden lost contact during the immediate aftermath of the storm. And so they watched from a neighbor's satellite television, and CNN announced on the morning of August 30th a need for available physicians to help in the Bay St. Louis area. So as soon as the storm passed, the two surgeons, they loaded up the car, filled it with fuel and all the identification that they had, and it headed out to Bay St. Louis to aid the physicians in the emergency room there. And they made a homemade sign, which they placed in the dash of the car to let the police and guard know that they were physicians. And once they were in Bay St. Louis, they were shocked with the situation that these brave and lonely physicians had been dealing with. The waters had risen to about 3 feet inside the building, inside the hospital, swirling furniture and equipment around from room to room. It was upending trash and depositing muddy silt in its wake. And they sloshed through the emergency room, and it was trashed. Muddy waters was still ankle deep, and two helicopters were on the ground carrying away the last of the stranded inpatients. Many people had lined up trying to get into the hospital for shelter, and they were turned away. The pharmacy had emptied its supply, trying to get as many people treated as possible. And the hospital personnel seemed surprised that a call for help had gone out over CNN, as they were trying to shut down all functions, given their lack of further resources. So then surgeons went out and were looking to see if their services could be somewhere else. And all the information they could get indicated that New Orleans hospitals had evacuated all their patients, and that all the Tulane doctors had gone to Baton Rouge. So after they contacted the hospital in Gulfport, Mississippi, and they saw that that was the only functioning hospital on the coast and only had one surgeon present there for 4 days, and they would love to have surgical support. So they went to Gulfport, and they were very surprised to see anyone come in to help the people there. The chief of staff worked immediately with it, took their identification, and they then had to contact the hospital in Montgomery, Alabama, where he had practiced earlier, and apparently he was still listed as active staff there, and they were able to send an affidavit regarding his eligibility to practice surgery. But Jim, however, had a bit more difficulty because he was on staff at a flooded, closed hospital, and so that hospital was unable to provide information regarding his medical license. So he stayed to aid the surgeon in the hospital, but despite efforts at the administrative level, they couldn't allow him to practice because they weren't able to get an okay that he was actually could practice surgery. So this is just one example of the problems that they had in Mississippi, and with this bill we hope that we can help, if we ever, hopefully we won't, but if we ever have a disaster, that physicians from out of state would come, would be able to practice here in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cruz and Senator Morissette, Senator Morse, and Administrator Robert Strzok. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm State Senator, District 11. Just preface my remarks, I do have a short written statement that should come before you, that I was visited by members of the medical community from the greater Mid-Valley area, as well as other doctors, on the day, you may remember, when the medical care professionals came to the state of Oregon, spent time perhaps with you, with a lot of members of the legislature, and they brought this issue to my attention. At the time, I thought I asked for legislation to be drafted, but then I subsequently learned that Senator Montes Anderson, your chair, had drafted this legislation. In 2006, the Gulf Coast in New Orleans was devastated, as we all know, by Hurricane Katrina. That was a Class 4 hurricane. I believe when it landed, it came on shore. At one time, it was Class 5, which is the highest level of ranking for hurricanes. Thousands of medical professionals from out of state wanted to lend their hand to help. very much in the American way. The American spirit is never better than when tragedy strikes a neighbor or another state. Unfortunately, because licensing practices are not transferable, they were met with legal barriers which prevented them from supporting the recovery effort. And you've just heard of one of those recovery efforts or attempts by the testimony of Chair Monis Anderson. To address this, in 2006, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws adopted a model bill. It was called the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act. This legislation allows a doctor or health care professional to volunteer during a declared emergency in a state where the professional is not licensed to practice. Enter Senate Bill 8. Senate Bill 8 would do the same for the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 8 establishes legal guidelines for recognizing other states' licenses for physicians and health care practitioners who want to volunteer in times of emergency. And, of course, my final paragraph in my written statement before you, I urge you to support this bill so that when and if Oregon experiences an emergency, and she is going to experience one of these. I mean, I'm sorry, if nothing else, it may not be during my lifetime, but the quake will arrive. And it, just as an example, we will have one of these emergencies. We are able to accept all the generous support and response that may come our way without worrying about licensing or lawsuits. Again, thank you for allowing me to enter a verbal statement as well as a written statement in support of Senate Bill 8. Thank you again, Chair Monis Anderson, for allowing me to enter to sign on the bill with you.
Thank you.
Are the dash ones yours?
What has come to our attention is that the state of Oregon already has a registry. And so I've been working with DHS, who are going to oppose the bill. And so we need to have some more work done on this. That the amendments have been proposed, and the dash ones did, are those that
yes,
just
they are.
Came?
Yes.
But I don't know if the opposition has
I don't see them.
Seen them. But we need that, we can't move the bill anyway. We need to look at the dash ones and see if it meets the needs that the intent of this bill was to occur. Okay.
Any other questions for this panel?
Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Wendy Johnson and Christy Nielsen. Please go ahead.
Vice Chair Cruz, Chair Monis Anderson, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. The Law Commission doesn't have, is taking a neutral position on this bill, but we wanted to alert you to that the fact that it does conflict with one of the Law Commission's recommended bills, House Bill 3021, which is scheduled to be heard again in the House this afternoon in the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. The Law Commission was asked by DHS and OEM during the interim to look at the issue of liability and in the issue of governor-declared emergencies and emergencies generally. The issue was what happens with our volunteers when they hurt someone else or they're hurt themselves. And so the Law Commission is recommending some substantial changes to Chapter 401, which is the exact same chapter that Senate Bill 8 is also making amendments to. As you heard from previous testimony, Senate Bill 8 is about out-of-state volunteers coming into Oregon. The Law Commission's focus was on our own volunteers in Oregon because it's interesting to know that we don't provide as much protections for those folks as we do out-of-state. Oregon already does have on the books EMAC, which is the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which protects volunteers from another state who are government employees, but we're still missing the private side of volunteers from another state. So Senate Bill 8 does take a piece of that gap, but Senate Bill 8 focuses on two things: registration, the credentialing or regulatory part of volunteering, but it also looks at liability of those volunteers, and that is also a direct conflict with the Oregon Law Commission's recommended bill, and also we believe with Oregon's Constitution. Senate Bill 8 provides immunity, absolute immunity for volunteers coming into Oregon, tort immunity. And we know from the Clark case, Clark v. OHSU, and from other Oregon Supreme Court cases on the remedy clause, that providing any kind of immunity to someone who had a right at common law is going to run into constitutional problems. And that's in Section 11 of Senate Bill 8. So that's, in a nutshell, we have no position on this bill. It's a different focus, but it does make changes and provides better protections, perhaps to out-of-state folks than our own Oregonians, and does have constitutional concerns. Any questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm just, I mean, the Clark case, I'm just wondering, I understand that one, but in a declared emergency, doesn't that dramatically change the environment? Because I think that's what we're after here.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just questioning if there is a constitutional challenge there.
Chair Anderson, Senator Cruz, when you look at a tort and whether there has been a tort, and usually we're talking about negligence, you do take into account the circumstances to determine whether the duty was breached. And so, of course, the emergency situation will be taken into account, but you still cannot provide outright immunity. Most likely, it hasn't been, you know, there's not a case specifically on an emergency situation, but given the jurisprudence, it's still questionable whether you can give immunity totally to someone who's arguably committed a tort, even if it is an emergency. There might not be a tort found because those circumstances were taken into account, but Section 11 just says if this volunteer participated, there's immunity.
I don't think we're trying to indemnify people from felonious acts, certainly, but
I think that Grant Higginson can come up too and let us know what the emergency preparedness is. It a department? Anyway, come on up and we'll hear his testimony. It'll shed light a little bit.
Thank you.
On what he feels will happen with at least this amendment.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I think many of you, if not all of you, know that the Public Health Division is responsible for the medical and health response in the case of a disaster were to hit the state of Oregon. And so this bill is extremely important to us. We are in opposition to this bill, and I feel badly to say that, because after hearing the chair's remarks and those of President Courtney as well, I mean, we're all on the same page. We want to ensure that Oregon has the ability to respond to disasters should they occur here in the state, and part of that is to make sure that we can pull from the private sector enough healthcare professionals to provide emergency healthcare services in the event of a disaster. So I think we're all on the same page. The reason that we have concerns with the bill are threefold. One is that we do think it is duplicative. We already believe that we have the authority in ORS 401.654 to create such a registry. It's actually already in operation. We don't have a lot of people in it yet, but we're starting a marketing campaign to get more. So that's the first reason. The second reason is we believe that it provides for potential fragmentation. Section 5 of the bill allows a health practitioner registration system to be operated by a disaster relief organization, a state, regional, or national licensing board, a healthcare facility, or a government agency. We believe that in the event of emergency, there needs to be one coordinated response. Right now, the law provides for the Office of Emergency Management and for the Public Health Division to set up registries, and we believe it should be one coordinated response rather than having a variety of people who could be deploying healthcare personnel in the same jurisdiction. And then the third and final reason that we have concerns with the bill was the one that was just raised by the Oregon Law Commission. Section 11 of the bill provides immunity, and as you heard from them, there are some real legal concerns about that. The way it's set up right now, if a person is within the registry and are deployed by the state during a declared disaster, then those individuals would become agents of the state. They would have Oregon tort claim Act coverage, and they would have workers' compensation rights as well. And we believe that that is a more reasonable response to liability protection than providing immunity, because once you provide immunity, then you get into some legal challenges.
And colleagues, I was talking with Mr. Higginson last night at 4:30, and the way we could address this issue is by submitting an amendment. We can still salvage the bill, and I checked, you know, even though I gave it to them at 4:45 last night, it wasn't ready at 8 this morning, but it would address the issues, and the only change it would make to our statute as existing is that it would add volunteers, and therefore they would become agents of the state and come under. Can you explain a little bit more on the safeguards then that we would have?
Madam Chair, my understanding of what we would like to see an amendment is to simply add to our registry that not only can we register people from our state, but from other states as well. And then there would be another subsection in the bill that allows us to work with other states' registration systems, other states' licensing boards, in order to get those physicians, nurses, emergency technicians, others able to register in our registry.
Now, if we have a disaster, of course, people aren't going to register in the state of Oregon until after we have the disaster. And so tell us how that wouldn't be an impediment to what we want to accomplish here.
Right. Madam Chair, we are hoping that we can register a lot of people prior to a disaster, and the hope with the marketing campaign that we're starting with the registry right now is to get at least 2,000 healthcare providers into that registry. So we are hoping to get people pre-registered. However, in the event of a disaster, the state also has the authority to designate emergency treatment facilities. And so we could say a hospital, or we could even take a school or some other facility and say, this now is an emergency medical facility during this disaster. And at that point, people can go to volunteer at those sites, and the person that would be administering the site would have a system for immediately credentialing and using those people.
Okay, yeah, any more, sir?
Thank you. Dr. Higginson, how much of this came out of the Emergency Preparedness Committee last year that met, the joint House Senate? I know this is kind of familiar. We discussed a lot of these issues.
Right, Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, our registry bill actually came out of a bill that was in the 2003 legislative session. Right after September 11th, 2001, of course, there was a lot of activity, activity, and the following session, we did a lot of work in looking at some model acts that had just come out, and one of the things that we were able to get in that 2003 session was the ability to create this volunteer healthcare registry. And I think that's what happened here is that we actually were out in front of the game on this one, and now the American College of Surgeons has come up with this model bill that says we want to make sure every state has this. I think that we were already ahead of the game.
Okay. Good.
So I think that we can make some significant change. Well, yeah, we'll basically gut and stuff the bill make it so that it comes in compliance and hopefully meet the Oregon Law Commission's concerns also. All right. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I do believe that we made these simple changes that would not affect the Oregon Law Commission's concerns.
Excellent.
Good.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 8, and I will open a public hearing on, or is it a work session? Public hearing on 804.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 804 requires clinical laboratories to release test results to patients upon receiving authorization from a doctor, dentist, or person who requested the test.
And Senator Bates, it's your bill, and I didn't warn you about this.
It's okay.
Do you want to, let's see who's signed up for 804, if anyone. No one. All right. And we have the Dash 1 amendments because I know that DHS had a problem with this bill in pass, and so I drafted an amendment to get rid of that problem. So if you look at the bill, we want, if someone wants to have the results of their test, exam, or analysis, they should be able to get that those results in writing to the patient. So we came forward with the Dash 1s. There was a concern about having 7 days as a limit, so that was taken out of the bill. But I know that Representative Jensen has brought this to us numerous times.
Session after session.
So I would like to know how the committee feels about this bill.
Madam Chair, I'm looking, if I give me a moment to find the Dash 1 amendment.
And could we have DHS come up just in case we have questions? Because I know that the lab had come before to talk regarding this. And have you seen the Dash 1 amendments?
Yes, I did hear about them yesterday. I think I have a call.
Oh, introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Senator Monsanderson, my name is Rita Yule, and I manage the certification of all the clinical labs in Oregon, and I work out of the State Public Health Lab.
Thank you.
Okay. The Dash 1 amendment removed the section that was put in the 2003 legislative session about after waiting for 7 days, a patient could go right to the laboratory to get their result without going through their physician. And actually, the Dash 1 removed that ability and kind of put it back to the way the law was prior to 2003.
And that wasn't the intent. The intent was that the person could go to the lab to get...
Right. In 2003, that was put in there. And I don't know who brought forward this Dash 1 that is now taking that out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If there's no further discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, there are two issues here.
Right. Mm-hmm. Two issues.
And they actually have some importance.
Okay.
One issue is that an ordering physician, if he tells a laboratory right now, let's take a test, I want all my CBCs done by your laboratory. If a patient calls and wants information, give them to it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told as a physician that's blocked. I have to give permission individually every single time. And that's impossible to do. Some physicians... may want to do that. Some physicians may not want to do that. That's up to the individual physician, and that information can or cannot be released depending on how that physician feels and how he or she wants to run their practice. But right now, in my practice, as an example, if I tell the various three or four laboratories I use that any information that is available to me is immediately available to my patients, I'm blocked from doing that. And we're trying to get around that bill or that law. That was my part of this. The other part is I believe patients have a right to some information here. This attitude by the medical community that patients don't know what's good for them is not correct. And I'm particularly concerned that I've seen many cases in which information was lost in the system, didn't get to the doctor, didn't get to the right people, and the only person who picked it up, unfortunately, was the patient and brought it back to the doctor saying, hey, I read my report and I'm not a doctor. This doesn't look right. What is this? And right now, you can't get that information half the time. So the way I'm reading this, if I'm reading the Dash 1 amendment, is we thought a 7-day waiting period and then everything became available to patients was appropriate. The Dash 1 amendment, does that take that out? What's the purpose?
That's the way I saw it. It took that out and put it, back in, because the 2003 took out the part about the physician, if they okayed it, the lab could give the results directly to the patient. That was in there. And then it was removed in 2003, so now we're putting it back in, and it's removed the seven-day waiting period. That's where the patient could get it directly. So it's just...
So we need another amendment.
I don't know why the first bill doesn't speak to it. There's a House bill coming through on a similar issue.
Exactly.
And they've taken my language and put it in their bill because they thought it was better language.
Right. Okay.
If I'm reading 804 correctly, Madam Chair, and I'll be sure that those who are looking at this with me, I'm reading properly. It says, one, that a patient after 7 days has an opportunity to get their information out, and that a physician, and I'm putting this in simple terms, can elect to tell a lab, I want my information available to my patients immediately. That's up to the physician's choice. So, I mean, that's what 804 does initially.
Right.
804-1, who brought that amendment?
I thought that was addressing the issue that the labs had regarding sometimes you cannot get the results within 7 days.
Point well taken, and I would ask that if it's not available, it's not available.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Not the issue.
The test isn't finished.
There are some tests take 3 or 4 weeks to get back.
Fungal culture.
Certain kinds of cultures, pathologies, tuberculin cultures, some ANAs, RAs, those things take a long time to go through the process and get them out. And we understand that. We're saying it's made of when it's available, you know, after 7 days. I don't quite follow this.
Yeah, I mean, the little piece of paper I got about the amendment, it kind of took out the lines that related to the getting access after 7 days. So I haven't seen it all, you know, together. And then maybe that wasn't the intent.
No,
maybe
that wasn't
the
intent.
We need to clarify that.
Well, if we have another House bill, I don't want to waste time with this one. It's your bill, Senator Bates.
We can wait for the House bill to come over and work then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If that's all right with the committee. Senator Morris?
Not to belabor it because we're going to have a chance to deal with this later, but there's a very substantive change in the amendment. The original language allows at the request for the results from the patient or the practitioner, and the dash one removes that. Very, very significant.
That's not correct.
I think patients should have some rights here.
Absolutely.
And the physician should have a right to release that information if he or she wants to also. That right was taken away from us in 2003.
Right.
I ran into it.
Right.
Well, 2 years ago, what do you mean I can't release information to my patients automatically, immediately? Well, state law says you can't. Well, that's ridiculous. I didn't pass a law like that. Oh, yes, you did.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
yeah?
Senator Bates, do we have a level of certainty that House bill is going to move?
My understanding is it's supposed to move and coming to us soon. I never know with certainty what happens on the other side of the building.
That was a dumb question, but...
Madam Chair, if you would be kind enough to schedule 804 for a work session somewhere in the distant future...
Yeah, and we don't have a fiscal anyway.
I would appreciate that.
But we would probably need another amendment.
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would be glad to put the language together that when the information's actually physically available, the patient can access it after 7 days, or when the information is available if it exceeds 7 days. We can put language together for that.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 804, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 381.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 381 was heard in public hearing about a month ago. We do have the fiscal and revenue available today, which we did not have available at that time. Senate Bill 381 requires health benefit plan to provide coverage of medically necessary treatment for persons with traumatic brain injury. And we have three individuals signed up too.
Well, we're in work session, so...
good bill should pass.
It's... there are no amendments, correct?
No amendments.
And minimal impact, and there was basically no opposition to the bill, correct?
Correct.
And so with that, I don't want to waste time unless the committee has questions regarding the bill.
No questions, Madam Chair.
We're in work session.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 381 to the floor to pass recommendation, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Senator Cruz has moved Senate Bill 381 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, yes. Just another mandate.
It is a mandate.
So my vote is conditional at this point, simply because at some point in time in my career here in the legislature, it would be nice to see all the things were mandating as a block and see what the total impacts will be. We do this piecemeal, and that's troubling.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I guess my feeling is that oftentimes insurance companies who do not provide health care stand in the way of health care. This is allowing people with traumatic brain injury to be identified and be serviced in a timely manner, which is part of the problem with traumatic brain injury. If it is not identified early, it can get significantly worse. People are not aware of the danger they're in. Some of the behaviors that they have may cause additional brain injury, and I think this is an extremely important bill. This is a condition that is not easily identified. Many people have it, people who, and it's a cumulative effect on individuals, and I think this is extremely important, and I think it should be covered. Thank you.
It was interesting that we didn't have opposition from the insurers. They said it was actually if it's medically necessary. All right, yes, Senator Bates.
Just a quick comment. I actually talked to one of my brokers who I trust a great deal. It actually is in Senator Cruz's district, Kelsey Woods, about the issue of mandates and where we should be going with it in this session. He gave me a little different twist on mandates, which I hadn't appreciated before, and he surprised me with his answer. In one way, mandates, if they're properly applied, actually sort of level the playing field. So when you're selling an insurance policy, you have a better idea of what that benefit package really is, and you can shop and compare better on price. I will also tell you that he felt that many of the products available are getting better now, and that he can sell products that have a broader and more easily understood benefit package because of mandates, but at the same time have more personal responsibility built into them also to help hold costs down. So I think this is one of the reasons we probably aren't seeing a lot of opposition to this bill. This is a mandate that basically probably levels the playing field. It's one of those things you think you may never need yourself. It doesn't have a huge impact except for the individual involved, and makes the benefit package more uniform across the state for something you really can't predict very well. So I think that's probably why we don't see a lot of opposition from insurers on this particular mandate. There's others that are questionable, and we'll have to take them one by one.
All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator
Morris. Question. In the bill summary, it states that it adds orthotic and prosthetic devices to the list of required coverage. It may be a citation.
I call legislative counsel about that cross-citation, and I was told that this was an opportunity to put something that was passed last session into the statute, so they attached to this bill. It has absolutely nothing to do with traumatic brain injury. And I did speak to that issue when we heard the bill.
My question, Madam Chair, is I know there's a tremendous citation existing ORS. There's no mention in the bill specifically to orthotics or prosthesis. Is it embedded in the ORSs that It's just a mechanical question.
When I testified, I had the ORS with me sitting right over there and cited the ORS and cited the fact that it was an addition by legislative counsel into this bill because they saw it as a means to put it in the statute. And why they chose this bill, I don't know. But Lori Freeman, I explained all that, and I thought I explained it, and maybe you weren't here that day, and I'm looking to see if I have that reference in my bill file. But it's nothing to do with this bill, which is interesting. And I don't care if we hold it over until we double-check this. That's not a problem.
It was just a question. It's in the summary, but it's not in the bill. Unless it's a citation, which maybe you've explained and I just didn't pick up on it, but it was just a clarification question.
And I don't write the summaries. Can you shed light on that, Mr. Shook?
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes.
In the bill,
I think one of the, if you want to get some clarification.
Do you want to get, can you clarify that, Sherry?
I can. It is listed in...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I am Sherry Stock, Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association. It is listed in the bill in the 2.5 pages of numbers. A number of those numbers refer to the prosthetics.
May I, Madam Chair? In the bill, I have it highlighted, and... throughout the bill, the number dealing with prosthetics are listed, and they do not have anything to do with traumatic brain injury. They're dealing with prosthetics, and that's the citation is 743A 020. I ask legislative counsel what the 743A meant, and she said that's because we ran out of room under 743, so we had to create a new section. What this tells me is we need to, at some point, go through the entire statute and reorganize it because it's getting more and more confusing all the time, and this is one of the results of the confusion.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tilly Smith with the Brain Injury Association. My understanding from Legislative Council is there's some legislation from the last previous sessions, and they've taken it upon themselves to clean up statutes with the new bills that have come through the legislature. We did not ask for this. We were very surprised to see it. And my understanding of talking with people in the building, other lobbyists and so forth, on medical issues, this is just coming through. And I know that, and Senator Morris, I understand your questioning on this, but this bill has nothing to do with prosthetic devices except for they inserted the language.
Well, I guess the question, Madam Chair, is what is the cost increase for insured products with this bill? And I don't see it in my bill file.
Let's have legislative fiscal address that issue then, or you think that the insurers should address that issue?
Well, it would be nice before we pass a mandate if we have some kind of an idea as to what impact it would have on insurance rates.
Have John come up.
Okay. Is John in the room?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, the mandate that passed last session on orthotics and prosthetics, I believe, did not reference health service contractors and multiple welfare arranged health plans. And I think this is just a technical amendment cleaning that statute up to make sure the reference adequately applies. It does not add a new mandate. That mandate was added last session when we worked with the people who brought that legislation forward and reached a compromise on the language. So it's not adding a new mandate. That mandate was placed in the law last session. This simply just cleans up the references.
Is that adequate?
And then the traumatic brain injury coverage.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, the traumatic brain injury issue, I think this is a clarification. I know at Regents it's covered. There is conflict from time to time in terms of different therapies that would qualify as being medically necessary. And I think that's what the issue is. I know at Regents they're working with several of the providers now to clarify those issues so the conflicts don't exist going forward. So we do not have, we're not opposed to the bill in its current form.
Okay. Thank you for indulging my question.
No, that's important. Thank you. All right. Any further questions? All right. We're in work session. The clerk will call. And we have a motion on the floor.
Senator
Bain?
Aye.
Senator
Morrison?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Morissette will carry the bill. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 796.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 796 was heard actually last week, carried over to today. It requires death care consultants to be licensed by the state mortuary and cemetery board, and does a number of other items that require some additional amendments, which you have in your packet, and they are stapled and quite lengthy, about 4 or 5 pages.
Okay, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Joining me at the table here is Michelle Gaines, Executive Director of the Cemetery and Mortuary Board, or Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I think I got that backwards. You have the -3 amendment. We had it in a -2, and then at the last minute, the realtors made another suggestion, so you have a -3. The -3 amendment makes the following changes that were suggested by you all and also by Ms. Jarvis at our first public hearing. We clarify the definition and scope of death care consultant as requested by Senator Morris. We remove the language from the real estate disclosure statement while still requiring disclosure of any interment of human remains that we still want to make sure we know where grandma's buried. We removed the requirement for written consent from a lien or mortgage holder for interment on property based on feedback that we'd received that was too onerous and maybe difficult to obtain. So those are the changes. I think, did we also add the scope of House Bill 3229?
It was in the -1.
Okay, that was already in the -1, which addresses the definition of an indigent for the purposes of disposition, and we sort of clarified cenotaph definition for payment, and that was already in the -1. Since our hearing, my email's been smoking a little bit with some of the folks in the industry who act as what we will now be calling death care consultants. Many of them sort of had a black helicopter view of what we are trying to do here. I did meet with two of the women in the industry yesterday. I thought we had a very good conversation to clarify that this is for protection of the consumer. It's not to put these death care consultants out of business, which was sort of the view by some, that this was an intent by the funeral industry, by the mortuary folks, to get rid of these death care consultants, and that is not the case at all. What I clarified to them yesterday and what I clarified to this committee is that we need consumer protection, and I actually think this strengthens their ability to operate in the state with a license as a death care consultant. We don't use the term death midwife in the bill, though that is a term some use, because the nomenclature is still changing. We think death care consultant more broadly defines it. I assured the ladies in my office yesterday, one was appearing by telephone and one in the office, that they would have abundant opportunity during the rulemaking process to make sure this new licensure will meet their needs. I felt that the conversation
conversation was a good one, and I understand they've both signed up to testify in opposition, so I'm not sure what that's all about. I did encourage them both. They felt that they wanted a seat at the table on the board, and I said that's not in this bill. That's in another bill. One of those bills sits in your committee here, Madam Chair, House Bill 2058, thank you, Michelle, and that's one of the licensing boards. There is conversation going on with the board now. Presently, I've asked Ms. Gaines to discuss this issue with the board, and they're reviewing whether the board should, in fact, have 11 members, whether it needs to be reduced. Currently, there are four public members who serve on this board, so, excuse me, so quite frankly, I think the public interest is protected, and it's just not dominated by the industry, which was what was being indicated to me in some of the emails that I was receiving. This is, as I indicated, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a serious business that we're talking about when we're talking about the death of our loved ones. There's no time to play around here and allow just anyone to hang out a shingle and help a family get through this, because these are very difficult times for families. We want to make sure that everything is on the up and up. And it's not accusing anyone of fraud, but I will tell you there has been fraud in the industry, and that's why the board was created in 1985 to assure Oregonians that their loved ones are going to be taken care of, that your money that you put into a pre-need trust is protected, and we've had to adjust the rules over time about that. And now this new emerging industry of death care consulting needs to be regulated so that consumers are protected. I got the impression from the ladies yesterday that they, one of the things this bill did for them was bring them together and make them realize that, yes, we should come together as an association. I encouraged that. I said you can form a 501c3, become an association, and bring legitimacy to what you're doing, as long as you have continuing education credits for your members, which, in my view, continuing education is important for any kind of licensed individual. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Gaines to see if I've left out anything or you need any questions answered.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Michelle Gaines, and I am the Executive Director for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I won't, there's no need to add much to that, I don't think, other than to clarify that on the record that on behalf of the board, we do think that this is an excellent opportunity. Funeral service is as broad and diverse as there are religions and cultures and personal preferences. There has been a tremendous amount of evolution in the death care industry, if you will, and in consumer demand. And it's important for this board to have legislation like this in order to address that evolution. I also want to say on the record, as I did in the last public hearing, that the administrative rulemaking process and the work of the board is a public process, and the intent is to work with all aspects of the industry and practitioners in the interest of consumer choice and consumer protection.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Bates.
Just a comment. I'd like to publicly thank Senator Walker for bringing all this forward. She's done more than just this. She's also worked hard to work with the board, which has had new leadership now as moving forward, and she's worked hard to bring fees back up where they should be. They haven't been changed, I think, since 1982 or something. She fully understands that this industry, if we call it industry, I guess, has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. People are dealing with these issues in a different way. But I also think there's a huge opportunity here for people take advantage of people who are in crisis, and this will help prevent that from happening. So I really want to tell her, appreciate her efforts and thank her for efforts for doing this before Oregonians who are in crisis, their family when someone dies, are abused by individuals who can take tremendous advantage of people in these situations. So thank you very much. Appreciate it greatly.
You're welcome, Madam Chair and Senator Bates, and I appreciate that recognition, and I do want to owe a debt of gratitude to Ms. Gaines. As I told the women in my office yesterday, this board was pretty much non-functional with its leadership, and they have nothing to fear from Ms. Gaines. She is just top-notch, has gone out of her way to do the research, do the homework. She provides me with all kinds of information, and she's able to answer every objection motion and question in detail. She's very attentive, very open, and it is a new world order with this board. And we saw it in Ways and Means when we voted last week on their budget. And I just think that this is really opens the line of communication. It allows for consumer choice. We are not shutting out any consumer choice here at all. I mean, some of these options I would not do, but that's my personal preference. But I don't want to shut out the opportunity for someone else who wants to be buried in a disposable coffin that, you know, disintegrates into the earth, or they want to be frozen or freeze-dried or whatever the method is, or a home burial. If they want a home burial, hey, you know, let them do it. But let's have some uniform rules in place across the state and make sure that everyone who is advising people on these issues has some kind of a license to operate. It gives legitimacy to the individual providing that service, and it gives comfort to Oregonians knowing that the state is watching people who are involved in this industry and are taking care of the concerns that they have. So I wholeheartedly support what we've done here in the Dash 3, and we encourage you to vote for those today.
Madam Chair.
Yes. And we're
done. Thank you very much. And thank you, Senator Walker, for bringing this bill forward. I'm kind of curious about what records we might have historically of home burials and burials on private property.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the currently under Oregon law, any kind of burial on a what's called a family burial grounds has to comply with the local planning district.
I understand that.
Right.
Historically, do we have records of where people are buried historically? That could be an important historic fact. I mean, I know there are cemeteries. Well, I'm talking about private property.
And that is part of the problem that we're wanting to address, is mm-hmm. that sometimes yes and sometimes no. What we're trying to establish is that, yes, they have to be maintained and they have mm-hmm. to be disclosed.
Yeah.
Because there have been issues from burials that happened 50, 60, 100 years ago that mm-hmm. weren't documented, that then are found when there's either an individual who's purchased the property mm-hmm. or if they're doing a larger development. So this bill is
yeah.
looking very far
okay.
forward.
And Madam Chair, if I might, and Senator Morissette, you know, some counties have done a better job about documenting these burial sites than others because, for instance, the Russian community near Woodburn, they do prefer to bury their family members on their property. That is their method of disposing of their remains. And so that county, I think it's Clackamas County and Marion County, they have worked very hard to make sure that those remains are documented and that they clearly have a cemetery demarcation. But other counties have not dealt with these issues as well. So we just want some uniform yeah. statewide standard to be able to locate our relatives. And, you know, if you prefer to be buried, it is a good thing in the future when your generations beyond you, after you've long gone, come along and, oh, there's Grandma. I remember when she served in the state Senate. And what a neat lady. Well, I'm not going to be buried. And no future generations are going to find my little tombstone or marker. I'll be off on the ocean somewhere with my ashes. But there may be a cenotaph we put somewhere, a memorial or a scatter garden that we create where others can come and view where Grandma used to be. So, you know, it is a changing industry, and we just want to make sure that we're taking care of business.
One other question. Do we honor Native American burial grounds?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes. There are provisions in the existing laws that address that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, you referenced the definition of a death care consultant.
Mm-hmm.
Could you direct me to that? I'm searching, and I must be dense this morning.
It's on the first page.
It's on the first page of the Dash 3 amendments. I know I was kind of wondering where that was yesterday.
Right.
But it's 15, here, line 15. Madam Chair, Senator Morse, sub 3.
They're going to support these new amendments.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Does that take care of what
that
you were looking for?
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
One other thing, Madam Chair. Senator Walker, I heard on NPR the other day from a, I think they call him a fluologist, someone who deals with the stuff out in the ocean and the currents that distribute, that if you put your ashes in the ocean, you are liable to end up on all shores all over the world. It just disperses
wow.
them. So that's something to look forward to. If you've never traveled the world when you're alive, you may do it after.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, since I don't even have a passport, I'm embarrassed to say.
You won't need one.
I won't need one. When they spread my ashes out over the ocean, I think that's absolutely wonderful, and it makes me want to do that even more. So thank you very much.
Okay, we need to move on. We have two more witnesses, Rosemary Harden and Nancy Ward, and please make your comments brief.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Rosemary Harden, and I represent the 20 or so home funeral guides that are in Oregon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, today I'm going to be very brief. I'm going to talk a little bit about the services that home funeral guides provide, and then give you just a very brief history about home funerals in our country, and then just some concerns that we have with this bill. As a group, we're concerned with what seems to be a fair amount of haste in wanting to regulate a few home funeral guides. Again, there's only about 20 that we know of in the state. And basically what we do is we offer information, support, and help to families who want to care for their dead loved ones in their homes. And so we're sort of perplexed by what feels like a very hurried need to kind of police and regulate us. Caring for our own dead is not a new concept. Before the Civil War, that's what we did. That's what families and communities did when somebody died. And that was, the Civil War was about the time that professional funeral directors and embalmers came on the scene. The community and family members would care for the dead loved ones in their home. They would wash the body and create rituals that mark their passing. Back in those days, death was a frequent house guest, and there was a lot of practice in caring for dead and creating those rituals. And there was a lot of knowledge about how to do it safely, lovingly, and respectfully. And then as medicine improved and people started living longer, death wasn't such a common experience anymore. And as a culture, at that time, death care basically moved out of the hands of families and community members and into the rooms of commercial funeral homes. And as our culture became increasingly disconnected from death, we were happy to turn that the duty of taking care of dead loved ones over to professionals, where it's been ever since, with a few people and a few cultures continuing to do home funerals. Most people today have little experience with caring for dead loved ones, and that's where home funeral guides come in. We provide support on the practical aspects of caring for a deceased loved one, and we also may help facilitate funeral rituals or services requested by the families. But the families always retain custody of the body, and they're the ones that create the funeral. We basically are facilitators and support. Home funerals are a green alternative to conventional funerals. A family bathes and dresses their loved one. Sometimes they build a coffin. Oftentimes they decorate a burial shroud or a cremation container. And the funeral can last for a day or more. Home funerals usually do not include funeral directors and never involve the use of toxic embalming fluids. As social, environmental, and economic forces align in these very uncertain times that we're in, a home funeral is an intimate, sustainable, and affordable alternative to expensive commercial funerals. Senate Bill 796 wants to license home funeral guides. And so our question is licensing necessary? And if it is, if you believe it is, what do you see as the requirements? If licensing is inevitable, Oregon would be the first state in the country to do that. So this needs to be a very thoughtful process. As you consider this bill and the licensing of home funeral guides, I hope that you will keep in mind that not everything in life, nor death, needs to be regulated, licensed, or certified, especially something that's been performed by families and communities for eons. And so we ask that you not pass this bill until you are convinced that a small group of women who do this very important work because they are called to do it and operate from their hearts really need to be under the thumb of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. If that is the case, then we hope, as you review House Bill 2058, which addresses the composition of health profession licensing boards, that you will amend that bill to require that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board include at least one spot for a home funeral guide on their board or death care consultant as a permanent member of that board, and in such a way that it does not impact the number of consumers that are on that board. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes. What was the number of the House bill again?
House Bill 2058. And I believe that has just arrived at your committee.
Okay.
Do you have any?
I'm here for support and answer questions you might have.
All right. Is there any questions? Okay. We will... we need to get the fiscal and then debate whether we want to pass this forward, but I thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 796, and I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 911.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 911 requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules applicable to secure community facilities housing persons under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Madam Chair, a couple weeks ago, this committee passed Senate Bill 529, which required the Department of Human Services to work as a liaison in development of the transition housing in the community. Senate Bill 911 goes a step further and requires some very specific requirements of the transitional housing and the community.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr. I represent the great communities in Western Washington County of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 911. This bill comes to you as a result of frustration on the part of local law enforcement and neighbors. There are a wide array of issues we could get into, as you know, on this issue, but in the interest of time, I want to focus on a couple of purposes of this bill. What we're talking about are people who have committed very violent crimes but were found guilty except for insanity. They're sent to the state hospital where they're under jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board and at some point granted conditional release into our communities. Senate Bill 911 only focuses on those forensic patients who are placed in what are called secure residential treatment facilities, SRTFs. These are supposed to be the most secure of all housing arrangements. But are they? That's the question that's being asked across the state in recent years, and with the downsizing of the state hospital, there is movement to place more and more of these high-risk patients in SRTFs in our local communities. I had to learn the hard way. One of these SRTFs landed in Cornelius, in the heart of my legislative district. There are other folks here today that, and some at the dais with me now, that will give you a little more insight into the Connell House, but the short version goes like this. In the summer of 2007, Connell House opened with 8 clients, 6 men and 2 women. Their crimes included rape, assault, sodomy, kidnap, arson, and sex abuse. Most were Measure 11 crimes. 6 months after the house was opened and the individuals were there, the sheriff notified neighbors. Neighbors who were understandably upset. 6 months after that, reports surfaced of illegal drug and sexual activity at the house. One of the occupants escaped. Subsequently, the state closed down the facility. It recently reopened with lower-level offenders, but I think the jury is still out on future plans for the house, and the whole experience has taught us that there is a significant lack of uniform standards for these secure facilities. First, there is no definition of SRTF in statute or rule. Second, there's a lack of guidelines for what we mean by secure. For example, there's one facility in Woodburn which allows several clients to leave to go to work every day. Others around the state grant passes for unsupervised trips in the community. Again, these are SRTF, secure facilities. But in Pendleton, the newest facility is enclosed with a 10-foot alarmed security fence, doors locked 24/7 with security cameras. There's another SRTF proposed in Vail, which last year had a proposal to put a moat around the facility. Now, the moat's gone away, but they do have a 6-foot vinyl fence, alarmed windows, and the whole nine yards of security. Third, the other considerations vary. There's other impacts, parking, traffic impacts, health and safety, emergency preparedness, what I would call just the basics if you're going to have a secure facility. In fact, just a few nights ago, there was a fire at a home next door to the Connell House in Cornelius. What would have happened if the fire had spread, the flames had spread to the adjoining house, and the offenders had to be evacuated? There's no plan. Fourth, training. The Connell House, when they advertise for employees, they advertise on Craigslist. Besides being 18 and not having TB, there wasn't a lot required before you could be hired, and very minimal training was expected. For example, what happens if staff walk out or go out for a walk and one of the offenders takes off, or worse yet, attacks a child? We've had cases where staff calls PSRB before they call 911. That's not right. As you know, there's a governor's task force that looked at these issues during the interim. The governor convened a large group of stakeholders involved in the whole community placement. There's a bill that's working its way through the process that comes out of that task force. They produced a list of recommendations. Actually, Senate Bill 911 was on their list of recommendations, calling for safe and effective operation of SRTFs to include facility security issues, staff training, and other issues. This bill just handles one of those recommendations coming out of the governor's task force. We have talked to Richard Harris at DHS. They're understand the purposes of the bill, are fine with the bill, and in fact believe that they can accomplish the purposes of this bill within their current budget. I know that's important in our budget environment that we're in now. One last item I want to put on the table, as far as it relates to standards and community placements for SRTF clients. As you know, we have a -1 amendment. I believe you have it in your packet. This deals with notification of district attorneys. My district attorney in Washington County and others, I believe, deserve better notification whenever one of these highly dangerous offenders is up for conditional release hearing, and certainly when a release into the community is approved. Now, I understand that there's issues here with the -1 amendments, and we are currently, in fact, prior to the hearing or prior to our testimony in the hall, the district attorneys were talking to the PSRB. I believe we can negotiate a agreement there as it relates to notification of the district attorneys. I'm happy, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for you to move the bill as is, and we can continue those conversations as the bill moves through the process, get the amendments adopted perhaps on the House side, and then bring the bill back for concurrence. So recognizing deadlines and where we are in the legislative process, you know, if we can move the bill as it is, allow that conversation to continue, that would be fantastic. Finally, I've always been a big supporter of Oregonians with mental health issues, and will continue to be. And this isn't some unfounded, hyped-up fear, and it's not in my backyard problem either, though I will tell you, each of us will, as legislators and policymakers, more and more we're going to have these kinds of facilities in our districts. And if you haven't already, your constituents will let you know about it. I believe neighbors deserve the highest security standards possible. I urge you to adopt Senate Bill 911, send DHS the message about these facilities before there is a tragic accident, before we move any more dangerous people into the community. We can do a better job of protecting the public. I appreciate your time, and I would like to turn the microphone over to my colleagues here. We have individuals that have come from my district and from Milwaukee that are neighbors to these kinds of facilities, so I appreciate the hearing today and the ability to get comments on the record.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the Chair, my name is Paul Rubenstein. I'm Chief of Police for the City of Cornelius. I'm also on the Board of Directors of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and I am representing them here. I won't repeat what the Senator said. He covered issues there. What I will address is Senate Bill 911. Number one, this codifies a lot of the work that was done by the Governor's Task Force and will go a long way to making it so that we become advocates for these facilities, not opponents. So when I can tell my community that this is safe, because they will come to me and ask, or in the planning process, we help move those mentally ill clients out into the community in a manner that everybody can accept it. The notification issues, I'll let the district attorneys discuss, but this really codifies the agreements that we have in place that are working informally now. And I urge you to support the Senate bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Sean Fisher. I'm a lieutenant with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. And again, I won't repeat all of the good words that have been said so far, but I am here representing the sheriff. And he does, and we do support this bill. I think I can summarize it by saying this. This bill is a very reasonable, common sense first step towards solving these issues and hopefully preventing the kind of concerns that were that came up as a result of the Connell House situation that I was involved in with the chief. So we think that adopting these kind of rules is going to go a long way towards creating the type of environment that does two things. One, it provides a good opportunity, a good environment for the therapy that these folks need, the healing part, but it also will provide an environment, as the chief just mentioned, where our citizens can be confident that these homes are safe and secure and that we can all live peacefully together. So we do support this bill. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Ben Morrison.
I received a call from Bob Repine, who used to be with the community in community development, to inform me that he's talking with the city of Springfield, which is my city, about a facility that would house, I think, 12 individuals. Half of them would be forensic, half would be civilly committed, and that because the city of Springfield had some problems in the past, he wanted to give me a heads up and is in discussion with the city right now. I have not heard anything about the progress of discussions. I support housing individuals in the local community where they are from. I think that's a good idea, but I also understand how important it is to give assurances to the neighbors and others that they're safe. It's a safe environment. So I'm interested in this bill for that reason.
Thank you very much. Let's call up Betty Fulmore, Rob Mack, and Jeremy Ferguson.
One of them was shaking his head back. We'll see.
Good morning. I'm Jeremy Ferguson, the mayor of Milwaukee, Oregon. Recently, we've encountered a similar situation where we have a home being sited in Milwaukee on Balfour Street. Mm-hmm. And we know that the Federal Fair Housing Act ensures that zoning and other regulations concerning land use are not employed to hinder the residential choices of the disabled, including unnecessarily restricting communal or congregate residential arrangements such as the group homes. But Senate Bill 911 requires standards that ensure that the rights created by the Federal Fair Housing Act are in balance with the neighborhood's right to safety and security. It protects both the residents and the community, the residents of the treatment homes, by ensuring trained, competent staff are present in the home, and it protects the communities in which those homes are located by establishing standards for security, health, and safety. It would also help us. We had to go through a lot of communication with the management organization that's putting in the house to discuss securement and protecting the community, and it would have really helped us out a lot to have some standards in place. So Senate Bill 911 ensures the responsible exercise of rights created by the Federal Fair Housing Act and deserves your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Mack. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak with you today. I live in Milwaukee, about four blocks from the proposed site of the Balfour House. However, my interest in this goes much deeper than that. A little over 10 years ago, on February 23rd, 1998, I had my first real job out of college. I was a field service engineer for a Japanese chemical company supporting chemical delivery equipment for Fujitsu Microelectronics in Gresham. That morning, I left my office on the ninth floor of the Bank of California in downtown Portland, right across the street from Pazos. as I stepped on the elevator, another individual came out from behind, stepped on behind me, and before I had a chance to turn around after pushing the button, he was drawing a box cutter across my throat, cut me within a quarter inch of my carotid artery. He then tried to cut me again. I blocked that one, and that's the scar you can probably see down my face. After this, I went through, he was on the street for about 3 months in spite of knowing exactly his identity and a description I gave. I was finally apprehended. I went through the long, very difficult legal process of postponements, hearings, and trials. He was ultimately sentenced to the state hospital for a period not to exceed 40 years, at which point I sort of thought maybe this was over. I could get back to, you know, getting over this myself. I am notified of these hearings. I attend those hearings every 6 months to 2 years. About 4 years ago, he came up as a candidate for conditional release. The PSRB had released their notifications a little late. I often travel extensively for work. I ended up getting this notification on a Sunday night before a Monday morning hearing. I attended that hearing. It was stipulated that he still was mentally defective, could potentially be violent to others if he did not take his medication. They released him anyway to Telecare in Woodburn. Shortly thereafter, a matter of months, he was found to be cheeking his medication and selling them to another person there, and the only reason this was ever discovered was because that other person overdosed, requiring medical attention. He was then revoked back to the state hospital. A couple of subtle things about that. I believe, A, that this did not show up as a statistic of recidivism because I was told that the system worked. Where I come from, in industrial automation and engineering, a near miss is just as bad as an actual accident. I never thought that here 10 years later I would still be dealing with this, certainly not at this end. As I said, I live near the Balfour House. There was an attempt to put this about a year and a half ago. It was stopped by the city of Milwaukee. The Fair Housing Act came in. I was actually in England, Newcastle, England, this late this summer when my wife sent me an email telling me that this house was going forward. You can probably imagine the trigger that this had on me, bringing back lots of symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. I essentially lost a day and a half of work, and here I am thousands of miles away, but the visceral and physiological reaction still stays with me today. There are many, many problems that I see with a lot of these situations, but suffice to say, I strongly encourage you to please support this bill. It is a first step. I think that's really all it is. There's a lot more that needs to be done here, but I have a six-year-old daughter. I have two sons, four and a year and a half, and I just pray that what happened to me 10 years ago can help that from happening to somebody else.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I think it takes a lot of bravery to come and share that, but it's so important for us at the dais to hear your concerns, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bob Junedef and Paul Snyder. And we'll have Paul Snyder go first. Paul, will you go first? Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, appearing in support of Senate Bill 911. And I won't repeat the testimony. I'll just simply state that the Association of Oregon Counties, among all the groups that you've heard from, were represented on the Governor's Task Force. And we support the outcome in the form of Senate Bill 911. It provides the opportunity to ensure that these facilities are operated safely and appropriately and professionally so that law enforcement and others can assure members of the community that that's the case.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedef. I'm with Disability Rights Oregon. We do not oppose Senate Bill 911. We do not feel it is necessary, particularly because these rules could be developed and should be developed, because it's very important that these homes are safe. And so if it's directed by statute, that's absolutely fine with us. In terms of the Dash 1 amendments that we have seen, we do have concerns about those. to the extent that they might cause a delay in the placement of an individual, they would require that there be a notification and then over a two-week delay in terms of placement of an individual into the community. If that delay were removed, we wouldn't have a problem with those dash ones. The problem that they pose is not that there is notification. The problem that they pose is that they would delay the clinically appropriate placement of a person into the community. These are individuals who have gone through a very lengthy clinical and administrative process in order to determine that they're safe, that all parties have checked off in that process. There's been a hearing in which all voices can be heard, and it is important that they have an opportunity to move back into the community. If there were a notification requirement that delayed that process even further, we feel that it would have implications in terms of the rights of those individuals under the Fair Housing Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act to move to the most clinically appropriate and least restrictive setting, to which will provide them with safe and effective treatment for their disability. I must hasten to add, because I understand that there are some passions that surround this issue. It's important to note that in terms of how we measure reoffense in this state, we use something called a recidivism rate. And people who are released from the Department of Correction back into the community have a recidivism rate of approximately 30%. Recommission of felonies. People who are released under the jurisdiction of the PSRB have a recidivism rate in the area of 2%, actually less than 2%. We place an enormous amount of resources and care in terms of the treatment of these folks and the supervision and the evaluation of their dangerousness. We do that for good reason, and I think that the results bear out that the system works. I appreciate the chief's comments that we all want the system to work and continue to work, and I think it's very important that it does. Senate Bill 911 should help that. The delaying the placement of people due to notification and to district attorneys that has a two-week delay would not help that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
I'm Bates. He's Cruz.
He horrible.
As I read the amendment, and I want to make sure I'm reading this correctly, present law requires within 15 days of the conclusion of a hearing that the board, PSRB board, has to notify the individual. Has to notify an attorney representing the individual, the attorney general or other attorney representing the state, written notice of the board's decision. As I read the amendment, all it does is at that same time require the board to also notify the district attorney in the county which the person is going to be released. I don't see anything here that's going to delay that release. It's just one more piece of reporting that needs to be done. I'm going to make sure I'm reading this correctly, because as I read it, I don't see how it delays anyone leaving the hospital. Yeah. It only requires more reporting, which is being done anyway. It just modifies it to a wider reporting, which seems appropriate to me. So am I missing something here?
And I think that Mary Claire Buckley from PSRB will be able to address that issue, and they're our next two witnesses.
I'll wait for the next witness to come up then.
All right, thank you. Mary Claire Buckley and Len Ray.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Len Ray, and I am the administrator for Adult Mental Health Services for the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Department of Human Services. I'm going to just simply summarize this. Everyone has said quite a bit so far. This legislation creates minimum standards and is consistent with the governor's task force on siting. Passage of this bill will keep public confidence in both DHS and PSRB's ability to manage this population in the community. And passage of this bill will also serve as a demonstration of the legislature and DSH respect for the concerns of the public. And as it reads now, we support this bill.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And as to the original content of Senate Bill 911, the board would support and echo Mr. Ray's comments. In fact, this process has begun. There has been a meeting to start the discussions about establishing a rule particular to these facilities. And moreover, I would tell you that many of these elements are already in place for in terms of the minimum training standards. There are more standards required of PSRB homes, and I'm involved in that than in other facilities. So I think we are working to, we already have enhanced systems, and this will only, codify what, in fact, we have intended and what came out of the governor's work group. We also in our office do much to ensure, as this would require, the compliance with the conditional release order of the board by staff and case managers who are responsible for our clients when they're released to these facilities. So based on that, we would heartily endorse this as well. The board's concerns are with the Dash 1 amendments. We have a couple of concerns. One in terms of the need, and secondly, the unintended consequences. But to your question, Senator Bates, my reading of this, we have no opposition if it were to read as you stated. The board has no objection to expanding the notice provision to the district attorney of the receiving county. Right now, the board is required by law to provide notice to the judge who commits the individual, the district attorney from the county of commitment, any victim, as well as the AG who handles these cases in most instances. As a result of some concerns that came up after the Connell House and discussions prior to the formation of the governor's work group, I met with, and governor's representatives met with representatives from the Sheriff's Association as well as the police chiefs, and we instituted a protocol where the board now provides notice after once an individual is determined to be conditional or is authorized for conditional release by the board. We send a letter to the police chief of the community where the individual is to be released, as well as to the sheriff of that county. So we've added that, and if one wants to include that in the statutory provision, that's fine by us. We do it already. But Senator Bates, when we read this, it's, and that was my concern. I had these conversations yesterday evening with staff, because the way that the board reads this would be that they would have to have this notice 15 days before the person is conditionally released. And so if, in fact, the board makes a decision yesterday that the individual is appropriate for conditional release, there is a bed available in the community, the language, as I read it in the statute, says that the person couldn't leave the hospital and go on conditional release until 15 days after. And so if, in fact, if we went up to 9A and just added the district attorney of the county from which the person was committed and the district attorney of the county in which the person is residing, that would be fine, because that says basically when we have a hearing, we provide notice in advance of the hearing to the parties that's set out by statute, and then after the hearing is held, we generate an order, much like a judgment order in a court, and that is what has to go out within 15 days. It takes, the board makes a decision, I have to generate an order in the following week usually. It has to be signed by a board member at the next hearing date, and so that's what the 15 days says, that I have to generate that order and get it signed and out within 15 days after the hearing. It does not say that the individual has to remain in the hospital waiting for that order to be sent out. The conditional release is effective the day the board makes that decision. So I think if one were to adopt this, it would result in the delay of individuals being released from the state hospital. Not only the 15 days, but likely more, because it takes us, as I said, the 7 days to have the order prepared and signed, and then one day to get it out of our office. So it could actually end up being 23 days in reality that an individual would remain at the state hospital in that level of care before they could go to a bed that's waiting for them in the community, which obviously would have not only a clinical but a fiscal impact, because here you are paying for a bed at the hospital that they no longer need and paying for the community to hold a bed open while this person awaits this notice to be mailed. So that's the concern that the board would have with that particular provision. I think it does, you know, have the unintended consequence of slowing down the process. However, we were having discussions prior to commencement of this hearing, and in terms of we're having discussions with the district attorneys, and I think that we may be able to resolve some of the issues by just adding that. And then I would also say that we do probably more than 800 hearings, full hearings, face-to-face hearings per biennium, as well as another 550 administrative matters. And initially this amendment talks about giving 30 days notice for each one of those hearings, which would definitely slow down the process. And in fact, very few of those cases does a district attorney actually want to, you know, play an active role. The Department of Justice represents the state in most of those cases. And so what we suggested was that there already is a provision in the statute that says that upon the request of any party or on the board's own motion, it could continue a hearing if requested. And what we would suggest is if the district attorneys want to codify their right to have additional time, which we grant as a matter of practice now and always have, you will not be able to find anybody who can cite to you an instance where the board did not continue a hearing at the request of a district attorney if they needed more time to prepare or to be present. But if they want that codified, the board would have no objection to putting in that particular statutory provision. That
well, let's need to wrap up. Legislative Council needs at least a week for amendments. If it's all right with the sponsor of the bill, let's request the fiscal and revenue for the bill as is, and then work if you want to change it over on the House side, if that's the wishes of the committee also. Okay. And evidently Steve Dahl wasn't signed up but wants to make a point. No? Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Yes, he does.
Yes, you do.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole, President of Crime Victims United. I'd again like to thank you very much for hearing our member, Mr. Mack, this morning. I think that we can't lose sight of, despite the fact that these people are suffering from mental illnesses, that the reason we're having this discussion is that they have victims. There's crime victims in this. We support the bill. We think it's a common sense and measured approach. We think we have to have complete transparency to our citizens on these issues as we move some of these people out in the community. I also feel that we need to ensure that there's a distinction between the mentally ill and forensic. I mean, it's one thing to have mental illness, to have mental illness issues, but it's the forensic people are a whole different group of people, and they're the people we're talking about here. The one point that I wanted to make is this. This issue of recidivism is one that, you know, you can jigger and change the way you measure recidivism. They do it in the Department of Corrections and they do it in the PSRB, and I can set up matrices and give you any kind of recidivism rates I want to, quite frankly. Now the standard
we have to go to the floor, so can you quickly?
The standard is this, is that they'll tell you that in the Department of Corrections it's 30%. They say here that's 2%, but they don't report misdemeanor crimes. They don't report crimes that happen within these homes that leads to revocations, that send people back to the state hospital. And I'd ask you to be very careful about recidivism rates. I think they're higher both in the regular criminal population and also in the forensic population.
It's yours.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 911. And colleagues, we're going to carry the rest of the bills to 6 o'clock tonight. I know that it would be nice to get a statement from Senator Bates since he is not going to be here. We are going to be hearing the Oregon Health Fund Board bills. I was hoping to be able to pass out if we have the fiscal on 453. And I did want to pass out 454. I'm not sure we'll be able to do that tonight, but I would like to also get a statement from you, Senator Bates, on the integrated home and which name you like, because we will be discussing that also tonight.
I will give it to you in a written
Yeah, that would be great. All right, with that, we're recessed until 6 p.m. tonight in hearing room
B.
B, here. Right here.